This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday, Week in Review time, beginning with the $42 billion state budget that is now on Governor Charlie Baker's desk. The budget was a couple of weeks behind schedule due to a fight over proposed amendments that would have restricted cooperation between local law enforcement and federal immigration authorities. Ultimately, those ideas were nixed from the final budget. Here's State Senator Jamie Eldridge, who filed the original amendment.
These are basic due process civil rights protections. And the fact that at a time when families have been separated at the border, that we couldn't do the bare minimum for immigrant families across Massachusetts is deeply, deeply disappointing.
Immigration advocates such as Ava Malona agreed. She's with the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Council Coalition.
It is a big win for the governor. He put a lot of political pressure, and he had said that he will veto everything. But it's really disappointing for the communities and for many families who will suffer.
Now, Governor Baker has a so-called clean bill in front of him, a clean budget, and has until the end of the week to sign it into law or to make line item vetoes. So let's get some reaction from our Week in Review panelists, including Jennifer Braceras. She's a political analyst and senior fellow at the Independent Women's Forum. Jennifer, it's great to see you again.
Great to see you.
Also with us is Marie St. Fleur. She's a former Massachusetts state representative and now a principal at St. Fleur Communications. She's also a consultant at Community Resources for Justice. They provide advice and strategy on community-based reentry services. Marie St. Fleur, it's good to have you back as well.
Great to be here, Mike.
Jennifer, let me just start with you. Your reaction to sort of the prolonged tension over the budget, and now that we have one, what do you make of the fact that those immigration-related amendments are out?
I think it's a good thing that they're out because it was holding up the budget, and it's quite clear that the governor would have vetoed that if it had gone forward. He's been very clear that he's not necessarily against these types of proposals, but he thinks they should be dealt with on a local level and that local communities in conjunction with local police departments should make these decisions.
Well, on Wednesday, Governor Baker actually did have some comments about this. He happened to be at a very, very noisy Green Line station. So we're not going to play you the tape because you basically only hear the Green Line trains behind him. But what he said was that he told Mass Live that he doesn't support the so-called sanctuary state amendments, never supported its inclusion in the budget, as you were saying, Jennifer. And then he said, quote, "We've made a series of proposals to the legislature that built off the Obama administration's policies with respect to public safety, which we prefer the legislature adopt. But we do not believe making Massachusetts a sanctuary state is a good idea." Marie, your response to that?
You know, I think it's a tough call. I mean, I think the ideas, having those ideas discussed is accurate. We need to have them discussed. We need to have them lifted up, and it's good that the advocates are on it. Having been in the budget process, having been vice chair of Ways and Means, particularly in the House, I do think the House acted consistent with the way it normally operates in that it really tries to reduce the number of controversial policy matters in the budget. Mm-hmm. And that I do think there is a need. I think what the advocates have to do is get a commitment that that policy issue will be addressed immediately. And so while it's out of the budget, I don't think anyone's saying they're necessarily, in terms of the leadership, I haven't heard them say they're against it. I think what I've heard them say is that this may not be the appropriate vehicle. And so we need to get right back on to advocating for it.
Well, in a statement yesterday, Speaker Robert DeLeo said, quote, "There's nothing in state law that precludes municipalities from adopting their own policies regarding their interactions with ICE." I mean, could that be Robert DeLeo's way of saying maybe the state house won't take it up?
I don't know. I mean, I think that's where the advocates have to come up and just continue to push the issue. They've got the Senate on the record as being for it. The governor has a piece of legislation I understand that he is pushing forward. So within those vehicles that are going to move and during the session, then they should be able to get that information on there. Mm. I do think we have to be clear, though. The Constitution does protect folks who are in our borders. The question is whether or not it's being applied. And so there's due process does apply to people. The question is it being applied? And so there is issue of enforcement, keeping a spotlight on police process and procedures, and making certain that each community is actually adhering to the laws that are currently on the books, and then providing that additional piece.
Jennifer, you have a thought about that?
Well, look, I'm from a family of immigrants, and I think it's perfectly okay for local law enforcement to cooperate with with ICE and with immigration officials when they, in their discretion, find it necessary to do so. That doesn't mean reporting witnesses to the Immigration Bureau, but when you have somebody who's been arrested for a crime, who's in this country illegally, I think reporting that person to ICE is completely appropriate and, frankly, what most law-abiding immigrants would like to see happen.
Marie?
I don't disagree with Jennifer's statement. I do think, though, that given the precedent that's been set across this country recently, that immigrants have a reason, particularly those who are here on refugee status, those who are undocumented, they have reasons to be concerned about whether or not their rights will be respected. And so I do think it's very important that we continue to put a spotlight on it and we continue to hold all our law enforcement accountable and as well all our service providers. But I am concerned that we can make a blanket legislation that removes the discretion that allows the conversations to be had because we have to, I mean, being a former prosecutor, I do think that there has to be an opportunity for conversations and as to whether or not to provide some discretion to local officials, but we have to keep an eye on it.
Well, so before we move on to other news of the week, I just also want to touch on briefly some other things that actually made it in the budget. The governor, I should note, he hasn't said either way what he's going to do with the budget. He's still reviewing all the details, because we know he's a very detail-oriented person. It is $42 billion, though, and it has a $271 million deposit into the state's rainy day fund, an almost 2% increase in last year's in spending over last year. I mean, overall, Jennifer, from the things that you've been able to glean from the budget, do you think it's a good compromise?
Budgets are always a compromise, right? It's always a give and take. And, you know, they did the best they could. The most important thing was that they have a budget.
Yeah. Well, there's also an independent calls for an independent audit of the Massachusetts State Police. Mm-hmm. And it would make daily fantasy sports permanently legal in Massachusetts, but without some proposed regulations and taxes that are still being considered by lawmakers. So your thoughts on that, Marie?
Well, I mean, I think it's a budget that, as I understand it, went almost about a half a billion dollars above and beyond where we've been in the past. I think that when you ever have that little bit of surplus that the winners are actually the so-called discretionary items, and discretionary items are where people are actually impacted. And so I am delighted to see that there's some additional money in that's been put in the for community as it relates to domestic violence. That is going to actually impact the refugee and immigrant community. I'm happy to see the additional money that's been put in for special ed because we're continuing to see the circuit breaker. There's been additional money put in there. I mean, we're going to continue to see an increase in support that's necessary for that population of young people. I mean, I think there's some really good things that are there considering that human services are always at the brunt, take the brunt and the hit. And I hope that the governor will support the work of the legislature in this, particularly the work that's been put in there for immigrants and refugees, particularly the juvenile justice pieces.
On the other hand, folks might say it's HHS that always takes the brunt because it's half the state budget. I mean, so there's a lot there.
Yeah.
Okay, but let's take our focus up to the federal level for a little while because it's been quite a week for the administration of President Donald
Trump,
to say the least, because on Monday in Helsinki, President Trump, standing next to Russian President Vladimir Putin, said this about Russia's interference in the 2016 election.
All I can do is ask the question. My people came to me, Dan Coats came to me and some others. They said they think it's Russia. I have President Putin. He just said it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be.
There was swift and enormous condemnation to the president's statement, including Texas Republican Will Hurd, who's a former CIA agent, saying that he believes that the Russians are directly influencing the president. He never thought he'd see the day. So reaction was so intense on Tuesday, the president then issued was essentially a walk back.
In a key sentence in my remarks, I said the word would instead of wouldn't. The sentence should have been, I don't see any reason why I wouldn't or why it wouldn't be Russia. So just to repeat it, I said the word would instead of wouldn't.
So, Jennifer, are you positive about the president's double negative?
I have no idea about the president's double negative. I do, however, have a great deal of confidence in his administration, in the foreign policy apparatus of the government, particularly Michael Pompeo at the State Department, Nikki Haley, John Bolton. These are all people with a long history of opposing Russian aggression.
I completely agree with you, but there was an extended meeting between the president and Vladimir Putin where nobody else was in the room except interpreters. I mean, he's not letting them into the process. Isn't that part of the problem?
Well, the question is whether he's listening to them. I think he is, but the truth is, to say anything else would be wild speculation, right? We don't know what happened in that room. For all we know, he was very tough on Putin and then came out and said those things, because what I've noticed about Trump is he does tend to play good cop, bad cop, even within himself. So he will come down very hard on somebody and then stand next to them and say very positive things about them, and vice versa. And so he plays this game, you know, that he believes to be effective, right?
How, I mean, is that any way to run foreign policy, though, to try to have
well, it's not
both
ideal.
Ways always?
It is absolutely not ideal. And I will be the first one to say that that press conference was an unmitigated disaster.
Marie?
I would have been stunned if Obama had stood next to Putin and equivocated about our own government apparatus as this president just did at Helsinki. And, the bottom line is we don't know. And it is absolutely wrong to conduct foreign policy in that way. We are a government that is supposed to be transparent. He's not an imperial president. He is not Putin. He doesn't get the right to go in and say what he wants to say without letting the people know.
He
represents us. He represents us. He may not need to tell us what the details of his conversation was, but he is acting in our name, not in Mar-a-Lago's name, not in Trump's name.
But
so I am actually really concerned that our legislator, our Congress, have not really stood up to really say this is absolutely wrong and we're ready to take any action.
There was
against
almost universal condemnation.
But honestly, been really weak. There have been a lot of words, but in terms of action, in my mind, it's
Jennifer,
been
go ahead.
The Senate voted 98-0 to say that the president should not accept Putin's proposal of allowing our representatives, our international representatives and ambassadors and diplomats to be interrogated by them. 98-0. I mean, bipartisanship is not totally dead.
Well, at least over this, thank goodness, right? I mean, but I keep coming back to this idea of all the way back in the Republican National Convention when the president accepted the nomination, mm-hmm. right? Remember, he gave that speech where he said, I alone can fix it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here we are basically 2 years later, and he absolutely meant it. I mean, he definitely is behaving in a way where I'm wondering if he literally listens to anybody anymore. And how can that be good? Where the very experts you were just talking mm-hmm. about aren't in the room. They're not present. They're not able to be part of the decision-making apparatus for the United States government.
So I think they are part of the decision-making apparatus. I think my guess is he does listen to them. It is not unprecedented for a president to be alone in a room with someone with interpreters, and there's nothing wrong with that.
But this is the hostile head of state of a country that our intelligence services uniformly
right.
have said have meddled in a U.S. election.
Right. And I agree. It probably wasn't a good idea. But it's not. There's nothing wrong with it per se. The American people aren't entitled to that level of transparency. There's nothing that requires that.
Okay.
As Marie was saying.
I want to add one thing here because, I'm harping on this, but
yeah.
The president not sort of letting key people know key things, it once again reared its head, yes, just yesterday, where Dan Coats, mm-hmm. the director of national intelligence, was on stage at the Aspen Security Forum, and NBC's Andrea Mitchell was talking to him, and she broke some news to him that had broken on Twitter.
We have some breaking news. The White House has announced on Twitter that Vladimir Putin is coming to the White House in the fall.
Say that again?
Vladimir Putin coming
to the...
Did I
hear you? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's going to be special.
I'm going to say that was nervous laughter by Coates and the entire room. I mean, I think it's shocking. He's the director of national intelligence. I mean, Marie, go ahead.
It is absolutely shocking. It is absolutely not in keeping with the historical practices of the office or with that of that branch. The reality is, even as president, you cannot be, I don't know where what your set of expertise were, you cannot be an expert on everything, which is why we have those trusted folks, as you've indicated, whether it's Pompeo, whether it's Haley, whether it's Coates, and you could keep listing them, that they are very important to helping really fill out what the decisions are, what the approach is, what the strategy is. And so it's a challenge when you only have one man that is making those decisions in our name, and we have no idea. We are assuming that the staff that we say that that has the expertise has had any influence.
Let me let Jennifer back in here.
We're assuming, but we're assuming it based on the record. And the record is that this president has taken steps to beef up our military. He has taken steps to allow defense systems back in Eastern Europe. He has taken steps that shows that he's been very strong on, sanctions against the Russian diplomats and kicking those folks out. I mean, the point is that what is so head-spinning about this is that the president's own words contradict the policy of his own administration. So the record is actually fine. It's just the things he's saying and catching people off guard is at a level where, journalists and even people in his own cabinet can't keep up. But, it certainly was embarrassing for Dan Coats. But to say that the administration isn't implementing the views of his advisors, I think would be false.
Okay. I think that's a fair point, because you're right. I mean, the administration overall has taken very specific actions against Russia. Absolutely. But it just makes me wonder, though. I mean, how long can there be this bizarre disconnect and lack of cohesion between the various actions of the president versus the administration?
So I think what's interesting as a political matter, and you spoke earlier about his remarks at the nominating convention where he said, I alone can solve this, right? I think that Trump supporters have never given that credence. And they've always felt that in voting for president, we are voting for the Republican apparatus. We are voting for the Republican foreign policy establishment to take control of that bureaucracy, and for Republicans to take control of the Department of Education and all of the bureaucrats and regulators in an administration. I don't think they ever felt they were voting for one man or that he alone could handle it. What they liked about him was the fact that he keeps everybody off balance all the time. And they felt confident that the policies would be handled by the experts. And I think that's what they see happening, because this hasn't changed their views.
I'm not sure anything is going to change the president's most ardent supporters.
I would agree with all of you, with both of you, that the policies of the administration have actually been very steady and have been very clear and then have been implemented.
And they are very similar to the policies that would have been implemented by, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, any of the other candidates that stood on that stage. They're very typical Republican policies for the most part.
And what I would suggest is, though, but there has never been this. If I'm France, if I'm England, if I'm all the other so-called allies that we ask to come with us when we are in trouble, I'm not certain how I'm supposed to take a lot of the verbose language of this president, and even some of the follow-up actions, because his action in standing with Putin and making those statements is action. And maybe for the policy implementation for the United States, it doesn't have any impact. But I think overseas that it creates some problems. I mean, the same thing happened, whether it was Korea, North Korea, whether it was what we're seeing, what's happening with families being separated. I mean, if that is what Republicans are saying was a good public policy, then I think we actually have to be very concerned, and the midterm elections are even more critical.
I just want to talk about one more thing, bringing it back to Massachusetts here, but connections to Donald Trump, because on Tuesday here on Radio Boston, along with the Boston Globe and UMass Boston, we hosted a discussion with Scott Lively. Mm. He is challenging Governor Charlie Baker in the Republican gubernatorial primary. He garnered 28% of the delegates in the state Republican convention, basically twice as much as he needed to get on the ballot. Very controversial anti-gay Springfield pastor says he supports President Trump 100% and that he has no problem with Russia's interference.
This is what countries do. What's the big deal? And especially when the only impact that that Russian involvement had was simply exposing information that Americans benefited from.
Jennifer, what do you make of that?
Well, I agree with him that there's no evidence that it had any impact. It's a fact that they meddled, and their objective was to sow the seeds of distrust in democracy, and in that they've been very successful. Did they influence the outcome? No, I don't think they did, and there's no evidence right now showing that they did. Of course, they put out misinformation, and Scott Lively is right that this is what countries do. I mean, we certainly try to influence elections all around the world all the time with propaganda. Ultimately, it is up to the voters to separate fact from fiction.
And but Jennifer, I'm going to jump in here. Because you know what Scott Lively never said in our one-hour-long conversation? He never said the United States government should try to stop it. That the Trump administration should work harder to protect the electoral integrity of the democracy of the United States. He never said any of that.
He basically said,
it's all right. Everybody does it. I mean, that's the thing.
Of course, it's not all right.
But that's roughly what he said, you know? And so that,
that's a problem.
So people who do that whataboutism about the Russian interference, that's what starts getting to me when you know, folks like Lively say what they do.
Well, of course, it's a problem.
With the Trump approach, isn't it? I mean, it's very consistent.
I take the Marco Rubio approach, which is, yes, this did happen. Yes, it was horrible. Yes, they've been trying to interfere for a long time, not just in this election. And this election was a wake-up call. We can't change the past. We need to focus on making our electoral system stronger to prevent it from happening in the future. Mm-hmm.
Marie?
Yes, it's happened in the past. Yes, it's been always a very clear reaction from all branches of government to say this is wrong and we're not going to stand for it and we're going to do more to protect our democracy. That hasn't been the singular message in this instance. And so, and the other piece is, how can we, I mean, I guess it goes back to this idea, is who are we as the United States? How do we project our commitment to democracy? How can we, in one level, say to the world, well, this happens all the time, and so we're not going to be concerned about it. But really, democracy is a great thing, and we want you to embrace it. I mean, our messages now are very muddled, and that we are not clear that democracy has to be protected, the apparatus of democracy has to be protected, and there must be transparent processes. And anybody who interferes with that, then we're going to take a strong line in.
Exactly.
I agree with that
100%. And there are different aspects of this controversy, and we have to be very clear. One aspect is sort of the fake news, misinformation, you know, stuff that was put out on Facebook by Russian bots or trolls or whatever. Mm-hmm. And as far as that's concerned, that's the type of stuff that nations do all the time, right? They spread propaganda and information. There's nothing you're going to be able to do to stop that in a free society, right, where we value free expression. There's nothing you're going to be able to do, despite what Facebook says.
Well, then there's also what the Mueller investigation has uncovered so far, mm-hmm. including 5 guilty pleas and multiple alleged contacts between Russia and people surrounding the Trump campaign. So
right.
There's that, too.
Well, right. So and we have laws that prohibit foreign nationals from making investments in campaigns and all of those things. And those need to be prosecuted. And we need to do our best to make sure that the physical apparatus of voting is secure. Yeah. We have to do all of those things. But what happens sometimes in this debate is we muddle all of those into one issue, and they're actually separate issues.
Well, you know what? I have to say I always appreciate the clarity and the civility of the conversations I have with the two of you. So thank you so very much. Jennifer Braceras, Senior Fellow at the Independent Women's Forum, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Marie St. Fleur, Principal at St. Fleur Communications and former Massachusetts State Rep, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back. This is Radio Boston.